Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Beyblade was great, mate. Everyone, because there was Pokemon when I was very young and Digimon as well. And then when I was 8 or 9 years old, that's when Beyblade and Yu-Gi-Oh came out.
Oh, yeah.
You're either a Yu-Gi-Oh kid or a Beyblade kid. And I did not like maths, so I just did Beyblade.
I didn't watch Beyblade, but I didn't watch Yu-Gi-Oh either. But I loved card battling so much that I almost, I did buy the Yu-Gi-Oh game. And then I was like, this isn't anywhere near as in-depth as I
Wait, the actual like card game or the actual, no.
The PS3 one or PS2 or whatever it was. Yeah.
I've got, one of my mates plays Yu-Gi-Oh! Master Duel all the time.
I got the arm thing.
Oh, the dual deck.
Yeah, the dual deck.
I don't know. I probably should get him it though.
The thing is, like, I don't know about you, but if you look at like modern, which probably hit record at some point, or maybe this is the intro, but whenever you look at like toy technology over time, we have it really good now. Mm-hmm. When you look at the amount of dexterity that wasn't there in a lot of toys that were around in the 80s and 90s, like the original Star Wars action figures.
Oh, the old Kenner boys.
Yeah, yeah. You compare them to like the way that like a Black Series or a Dark Series looks now for Star Wars, and it's like the machines are making better toys now.
I think there's always been different lines, hasn't there? There's always been ones that balance like dexterity and durability. So like if you're a little kid and you've got a little Spider-Man, you don't want to get the Fancy Dancy edition because you're throwing that guy everywhere.
That's true. And yeah, you'd always get like one-offs and stuff, but I feel like in general, like the average kid, the average person has access to really good stuff at the 20, 30, 50 pound mark. Whereas they used to be like a couple of
I don't know if it was some for you, Scott. When I was growing up and I really wanted a Batman figure, you could never find just the basic Batman. It would always be like fire action Batman or freeze blast Batman. It's like, I don't want a Batman that's green or orange. I just want Batman. And I couldn't find that back in the day.
Right.
But now you can find him everywhere.
I had the Frost Batman, but I was gonna say, I had the one where you could clip his cape shut on the front. It looked cool. But where'd you come down on, and we'll do questions at some point, where'd you come down on when they give like Spider-Man a car? You know, when it's like, it's Spider-Man and his web car.
I saw straight through that when I was a kid.
I know what you're doing to me.
I was not deceived.
No.
I always thought it was stupid. It's like, Spider-Man swings around. Why do you need a car?
That was my thing.
Yeah.
My brain went to Sonic there because there's Sonic Racing. And I was like, Sonic of all characters does not need, Flash isn't in a car, is he?
Yeah.
He's
exactly.
Running.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to be fair, I did get worked by Sonic Riders when I was a kid.
That's because it was a snowboard or a series of boards.
Yeah, he was skating. And I was also just there like, but he's faster than the skateboard. So why is he doing that?
Yeah. Well, at least look cool. Sonic wants to look cool more than he wants to run fast.
That's fair.
Oh, actually, I don't know.
That's good philosophy, that.
I've said that. All the Sonic fans listening to this, does Sonic want to be cool? Does Sonic want to look cool more than he wants to run fast? Would Sonic prioritize
cool
over fast?
I think we all need to look cool. We all need to prioritize looking cool rather than running fast.
Yeah, so it's a good life statement. Speaking of a good life statement, this is the Untitled Banter Podcast, the EVP, the UBP, the UBP. I'm joined by you in person.
Hello.
Hello. I'm Scott Tailford, your host for this particular thing. I've done the intro in the wrong way and I can't get my way out of it, but it doesn't matter.
Fine, we got there in the end.
Because we've got loads of people's questions and stuff. We'll get through as many as we can, whatever's going on in the gaming industry, whatever you'd like us to talk about. First question from Pinky, who says, Wahoo, UNBP, UNBP, UNBP. MBP. I will be buying my first fighting game in decades because of the Tekken 8 demo. And though Prince of Persia didn't grab me, I'm sure many have bought it on the strength of its demo. Are we seeing a renaissance of the lost art of the gaming demo? I want to include this because I want to shout out Square Enix. Because for the longest time now, they've done big multiple hour chunks of near finished code for their games. And also Capcom's Resident Evil 2 demo. That was like, here's a chunk of what will be the final game. And Square Enix are doing it at the minute with Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. But they also did it with Final Fantasy 16. They did it with Octopath Traveler. You could play like 20 hours or 10 hours or whatever of Octopath Traveler 2 just on the demo. And same with the first one, Triangle Strategy as well. Triangle Strategy is the one I'm thinking of. But Triangle Strategy was like, here's just a big old chunk of the game. So you know what you're buying. And I'm just like, in the modern industry, I want to champion that so much more.
Yeah, we need that back. There was clearly a point in time, like I want to say 12, 13 years ago, where someone at videogames.org was like, we don't want to give people demos no more. No. Because they're just spending time on the demo and they're not actually getting in the game. I remember, to be fair, and in their defense, I remember the demo for Just Cause like 2010.
What a time.
And there was the glitch that you could do to glitch out of the zone that locked you in
and
to
give
you unlimited time as well. So you still have the annoying countdown thing in. And most of the map was not rendered properly outside of that. But you could just spend time in the Just Cause 2 demo if you wanted to. So I totally get that. But at the same time, you know, I feel like beyond just the demo disc era that we grew up in the early 2000s, fond memories of the Futurama demo, the Futurama game demo.
I never actually touched that game, but I remember seeing it coming out. Yeah.
It costs like £1,000 now.
Yeah?
Yeah.
In the retro scene.
Because people are slabbing and crabbing, and I hate them.
But I feel, overall, like there's a few things to this, like in terms of, like, I remember when Bethesda stopped giving review codes out, and it was like, well, no one's going to know what this thing is until launch day. And it's obvious that that's just a money play. Like, you know, if you want to know what this game is, cough up the cash and don't wait for the reviews, which you then have seen so many other publishers do that.
Reviews don't matter, Scott. It's so irrelevant.
If you know you're going to like it, just buy it. But I remember as well on the Xbox store, you know, the Xbox Marketplace, every game would have a demo. Every Xbox Live game would have a demo, whereas PlayStation didn't mandate that. And I don't remember the game, but there were a few things that were out on PlayStation and Xbox, and I would go onto Xbox specifically to get the demo.
The Xbox Arcade Trials, they were class. I remember, because then you would have the option to unlock the full game after you had completed the little trial bit. Mm-hmm. I love that. We need more. I think the demos are great at getting people to explore things and try things.
Yeah.
Because I feel like when you take that ability to experiment away, you get siloed into the games that you're most comfortable playing.
True.
Unless you've gotten really strong and ringing endorsements and you're like, I need to check this thing out. Mm-hmm. I would like to see more demos.
Yeah, and I get the reality on the dev side of like game production's got exponentially more complicated. It's so hard siphoning off a vertical slice that you would then have at a trade show that maybe then you would use as a demo or something that impacts development overall. Like sometimes it is just better aiming for a specific finish line. But if it's possible, like having those chunks of near finished code and just hard cutting the level off or whatever it is, I still think is better than nothing. Even though I get that I have no idea about the reality of how you would do that. But looking at the likes of Square Enix and Capcom and some of the other game trials that have been going on, that's a great thing. Like Battlefield 2042, even that game had like, it was like you could play 5 hours and before it cut off, the game was in a state for the first few weeks. But yeah, hopefully it leads to better things. Question from Human Michael, who says, I want to hear best and worst Arnold movies from both of you. No, I'm assuming Arnold Schwarzenegger, but take that however you want.
Okay, so the greatest action movie of all time, Predator, obviously. The Running Man is a straight up banger.
Yep.
Total Recall, also, obviously you got to mention the Terminators.
You got to pick one though, mate.
The best one is Predator. Best one is Predator.
Shout.
Worst one, he was in a really, it's a shame because it's a movie that I actually really enjoy watching, but it's Red Heat with with Mr. James Belushi.
Okay.
Where he plays Raw Deal's worse. I'm going to talk about Red Heat because it's funny to talk about. Red Heat, he plays a Soviet police officer who has to go over to America to solve a crime. And it gets into a wacky situation because he gets paired with old James Belushi.
Shenanigans.
And things. And there's a great bit where he breaks up like a drug ring or whatever. And he breaks off a man's prosthetic leg. And then just turns upside down and cocaine falls out. And he just goes, cocaine them, because he's doing a Russian accent. You should watch Red Heat.
The thing is, like, you're way more of a movie guy than me. I'll watch the movies, but I don't keep up with them anywhere near as much as I do gaming or whatever. And so when I read the question, I was, oh, best Arnold movie. My mind just went to Jingle All the Way. I forgot Predator and all that kind of stuff, even though it's clearly Predator.
Yeah,
I love Jingle All the Way, though, just for, I guess, mostly nostalgic reasons.
Jingle All the Way is a great time.
It's a banger. For the worst one, I don't have many that come to mind in terms of something where I didn't, when have I never enjoyed watching Arnold in person, on screen, I mean. But I've never seen that one with Danny DeVito. Is that
Twins is amazing.
Is that amazing?
No. Twins is fantastic. I love Twins. If you want to talk about the worst objectively, it's probably something like Hercules in New York, which is very, very early Arnold. But yeah, great dude. Love him.
Yeah, big, big fan. Jack Asbury asks, after hearing about Embracer Group shutting down production on a new Deus Ex game, do you think there needs to be some sort of legal precedent where companies have to sell IP they've bought if they mishandle it? I don't know how you would ever enforce that.
No, I think that it's not something that's legally enforceable. What I would like, the issue here, it's antitrust stuff. You know, Embracer should not have been able to gobble up as much. I think the issue there is that there's legal precedent for acquiring companies and how many companies you own. There's nothing in there about IP and hoarding IP and licenses, which probably does need to... We do need to have a conversation about that.
Yeah, I think for the Deus Ex thing, it was like revealed earlier in the week. I forget the time. So many things have happened across the last couple of weeks. But the new Deus Ex game was apparently in production for 2 years. So I would have something in place that saves that work. Like, I don't know how it, I mean, you let the thing is, I'm too aware of the legal proceedings to phrase this thing because I know it wouldn't happen. But you want some way for the people who have put the time in to maintain, if they want to continue with the project, they get some sort of legal way of someone can step in.
Because the only way that works is if Embracer sell the studio / publisher, and then they get to take that with them.
Or they go independent and you get like an independent fund.
Yes.
And it's like, we calculate how much you spent across the last couple of years. You get that for the next, however long the game was in production, we give you that time, and then you get to go independent and work on it while you get a buyer.
Yeah. Interesting question. Like, because the way that we negotiate like company acquisitions and takeovers, the IP and the properties that are owned and accumulated by the company that is being purchased are factored into the value of the company and also into things like antitrust laws. It's why the Disney-Fox merger was so controversial because Disney would have a wealth of IP at their disposal that they didn't have before. But it's interesting that, you know, you can't be like, well, if you're taking up IP bit by bit from loads of different places, that is very difficult. That's kind of like a gray area in all this. I do think maybe there needs to be a discussion about that, because the issue that you have there is that, well, if the company, you know, goes under or is having like loads of financial difficulties, you either get stuff that is sitting stagnant in a vault, or you have to get people to then go and buy them back. I think Embracer are hideous. I think what has gone on over the last year, 2 years, it's just a complete scandal.
The amount of the big deal they were able to do, the amount of, I just think of the human cost of it, and it sounds potentially melodramatic, but I genuinely mean it. The amount of people whose lives were affected by that deal, you look at the sheer amount of studios and how big they were, the amount of projects, the amount of creative energy that went into all those various things that were then canned, or some people lost their jobs, etc. And the whole thing was hinging on a deal that hadn't even gone through yet. And so it's just a ludicrous state of affairs. But yeah, that whole thing about, like you said, when IPs change hands or studios get bought out, 9 times out of 10 they just wipe out whatever was going on beforehand for whatever reason. Sometimes that's a legal thing, sometimes the previous company has different contracts or whatever it is, and sometimes you're just better off, quote unquote, starting again. But it means that 2 years in the Deus Ex's case just goes away. So it's like, whatever legal thing you could put in there that would help in some way, if you're a coder, you're an art department, you're a whatever, and you've just ostensibly you've wasted 2 years of your life if you're hanging a lot of it on what's going to come out at the end.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I'm trying to think. I feel like there have been examples where a game studio has taken IP with them to a different publisher. And why is that struggling? Well, it's really
I think that has to be negotiated
of the thing. Yeah, whereas the thing with Embracer is that I think there does need to be more regulation of, you cannot just gobble up and buy the properties and IP licenses themselves. Like that in itself is an issue. It would have been regulated if they were buying loads of companies, which I know they have done as well.
Yeah.
But the licensing issue specifically in the IP itself, that that probably does need more regulation from competition and trust agencies.
I feel like you hear quite a lot about, that game was 3 years in, that game was 4 years in, and it got wiped out because they changed hands, or for whatever reason they decided so many years in that it was lost. I guess ultimately my thing is cutting through all of that stuff and being like, can we not salvage the human effort put into these works? Or for whatever reason, were those 2 years, is there nothing salvageable at all? Mm-hmm. I think that's the thing that I'm aware of, is just the, obviously we're creative people, we make stuff for a living. So it's like, if you did that for years and you lost it, it's like, what the hell was that? I would hope there's some sort of safety.
Saw a really sad tweet the other day from a game dev who was saying that he's been working in the industry for, like, I think it was like 10 years.
And three things had cancelled in a row. Actually, Elias Dufekis, the guy that's...
That was it.
He's the voice of Adam Jensen in the last couple of Deus Ex games.
Batman and Gotham Knights as well.
Yeah, and it's like, he was saying that, like, nearly everything he's worked on over a certain scale of the last 10, whatever it is, it's all fell through. He was like, I get it, it's the industry, I've got other irons in the fire, but that's the reality of it right now. And it's like, I would love someone who was of like an analytical mind, who knew multiple mediums inside out, to just be like, is this specific to gaming? It feels like it's more of an entertainment industry thing, where a lot of, like, you look at the tax write-offs in the movie space and things like that.
But nothing has the time sink like gaming.
No,
has.
True.
Like, years of someone's life, you know, like, you could say that, and even then it's like, if a movie is how many years into production, it's getting released unless it's Warner Brothers and they want to be scumbags. whereas with gaming, you can sink half a decade of your life into a project and it never be seen. And that is, you know,
that's a hell of a way to live.
A typification of just how weirdly unsustainable things are going at the minute.
Yeah, and it's like there's a huge element of trust in that we're starting this project under the proviso that in 5 years' time, the publisher's still going to be around, or someone's still going to be around to get it over the finish line. And if that finish line goes away, or they go, actually, we don't believe in this anymore, that has to be uniquely soul-crushing in a very specific way. The question from TJ, who says, can you explain where your and some others at What Culture's games accents come from? For my unrefined Canadian ears. Also, do you ever watch Mark Brown's Game Maker's Toolkit? Could be a cool guest. I feel like we're way below Mark Brown's Game Maker's Toolkit, but I'd love to have that dude on. I don't watch as much stuff as his as I should. It's always recommended, but his run times, he goes so in depth that all I can do is do a massive shout out to that guy. Like, I wish I watched more of his stuff.
I've not actually watched any. What are these videos
just
about?
Like deep dives on. He does a thing called, it's called like Boss Key or something as well, or Boss Design. It's been a while since I've watched his stuff, but there's a lot of like deep dives on game design specifically. Getting into the guts of how levels were made, how gameplay loops work. I love all that stuff. Josh watches a lot more of it than I do, or him than I do. And just shout out to Mark Brown's Game Maker's Toolkit over on YouTube. As for the accents, I'm Northeastern born and bred. I'm from a little town I was born in a place called Hexham. I lived in Prudhoe, and then I moved over to Newcastle. So initially, I was way more broad, know what I mean? And then it eventually, over time, got way more refined because I worked in retail for years and years and years. And I remember there was a specific thing when I used to work in Argos, which is like a UK shopping chain thing, that I was in like quite a posh area, and I was still quite broad, but obviously my accent must have been like half and half towards RP or towards being more refined, and no one could understand me, and they were just like, oh, sorry, what, like, oh, can you try again? And and eventually you end up sounding like this, where you need to have a certain level of minimizing the accent, otherwise it used to be way more of a thing that you can't
kind of around. A similar-ish story for me. So I'm from Liverpool, but I obviously don't sound like I'm sound particularly Scouse. If you put a few drinks in me, then it'll come out. But then we moved to Warrington when I was quite young, which is just a black hole in between Liverpool and Manchester. But I think the Scouse accent's wonderful. I think it's a great accent. So that's kind of explains what I'm from. I just have a really, you might be able to hear it if you really listen. But like you, I'm so conscious of how I'm talking and how I'm being presented, and then if it's like a video thing, there's like a different accent variations that come into it as well. Voices are really strange when, like me, you've lived in different parts for so long. I kind of absorb everything like a sponge, because obviously half Scottish as well. If I'm in Glasgow for a while, little things will come out. It's not like it's like I'm gonna just switch and, you know, become the big yin or whatever, but it's like things just, it's an interesting question, because I feel like most people, if they had to ask where I'm from, or like what my accent is, they probably wouldn't be able to tell you.
No, and I think like it is like a code switching thing, where like if I'm talking to my dad, then like, oh, you know what I mean? Like, I'll talk like this. Like, it's way more broad. And only three people that would have known what I just said there. But, like, for the most part, I'm talking like this. Not to name drop a celebrity person who I had a lovely chat with, but when I was at the Golden Joysticks last year, I was having a chat with Ralph Ineson, Game of Thrones. He plays Sid in Final Fantasy 16. And I was talking to him about, like, because I don't know if you, like, remember when it was a whole thing where you just couldn't have an accent online. It was, like, in the early 2010s. Like, when we were starting out Video on What Culture, it was, like, if you're going to be presenting stuff, it needs to be the most, like, toned-down accent ever. And it was Game of Thrones that changed all that. And it was like, I was just talking to him about that idea of like accents are more accepted now in terms mm-hmm. of being like online. Like you'll get, like there's a Geordie in Final Fantasy 16, a global franchise with a very specific dialect.
This is the other interesting thing. I think that that's so right, because if you were looking for accent variation in terms of pop culture for the United Kingdom, because so much of our acting class, and it is a class for the most part, have come from privately educated backgrounds where they've been to, you know, the Oxbridges, the Eatons or whatever, and they all have very kind of posh sounding voices. That's still the defining kind of British English voice. It's, if you were looking for variation in that, you'd be looking at best Sean Bean as Sharp in the 90s. And it's kind of gotten a little bit more now. Like the Stephen Graham's, if we're going to use like the Scouse example, it's gotten a little bit better now. So hopefully that is a thing that is moving forward, because I feel like, you know, it is, there is such a thing as accent discrimination. It comes down to classist attitudes as well. So hopefully that is changing the bit. We've gone very deep after all this, but it's an interesting thing to interrogate, because it's not something that personal. It is something that I've spent a lot of time thinking about as someone who is from Liverpool and feels very much very much like in link with the Scouse identity and everything. It has kind of been like a thing of like, well, am I Scouse enough? It's like a weird thing, but yeah.
No, I'm always like very aware of like, if I'm talking to someone that's above me in like the overall hierarchical structure of like the future, the guys that bought us out, then I'll be speaking a lot more like this and I'll make sure that they know exactly what I'm saying and I'm forming everything perfectly and whatever, which is different how I'm talking to you right now or Geordie if I was talking to my dad. So it's like, but I'm aware of that. I think some of that comes from just having done presenting work for so long. You're aware of like, I remember developing this thought process of like when you're on camera and you're talking, it's like, I'm aware that I'm talking, but I'm thinking as well, like I'm about to make this point. I'm going to do this. Like I'm double thinking the whole thing.
And if I've been in the voiceover space for too long, I will just forget what my default voice is. Like, how do I talk again? Maybe I'm just an alien.
No, I think we're all just navigating this. I think the content life deals a harsh card every now and then. But it'd be funny for us to do a whole video in our natural accents, like if you really stayed into it. Because like Josh is from a place called Bishop Auckland, and like and when he goes full broad, it's awesome. Yeah, and it's like, that's a whole thing. And a question from Morten Nielsen, who says, do you think Suicide Squad will be fixed over the coming months, in particular the repeating and boring missions? It is a live service game after all, so I guess it will be possible if Rocksteady listens to the feedback.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Before we go any further, I want to talk to you about today's sponsor, Masterclass. With the amount of time we spend discussing and analyzing video games on this channel, it's always good to understand exactly how these experiences are put together. And fortunately for me, I can do just that with Masterclass. With Masterclass's streaming service, you can learn from the best to become your best, studying and growing with over 200 plus of the world's leading instructors. For me, I've been having a blast using a class on video game design by The Sims creator Will Wright to find out exactly how game mechanics are designed around player psychology, as well as learning how important playtesting is to shipping the titles that you and I both love. But it hasn't stopped there, as I've also been brushing up on my practical filmmaking skills directly from my favourite movie director, Martin Scorsese, as well as trying to get back in the cooking game with Roy Choi's amazing course on intuitive cooking. Seriously, my kitchen is a mess, but my belly has never been more grateful. For just $10 a month, an annual membership with Masterclass gets you unlimited access to courses on your phone, computer, smart TV, or even via audio-only modes. Even better, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and 88% of members feel that the service has made a positive impact on their lives. And to put the cherry on top of that cake, right now, What Culture Gaming listeners get an additional 15% off any annual membership at masterclass.com/gaming. That's 15% off at masterclass.com/gaming. What's that? You want it one more time? Well, that's the URL, masterclass.com/gaming. Right, now I'm going to watch Tony Hawk try to teach me how to ollie properly. I'll see you all soon.
This is the thing. If we're talking, it depends on the level of fixed that you're going for here. If you're expecting something like the linear brilliance that we had from the Arkham games, no chance.
No.
I think what we're getting here is it's still going to be enemies on rooftop, or take down big squishy thing, or take down a variation of boss fight. Maybe I don't think that they have the time or the resources to be, we're going to do actual proper missions in this. No. It's going to be the variation of escort vehicle, destroy thing, rescue hostages, which is a shame. I feel like there are certain, you know, in the weeks that have settled since the game came out, there are things that I can praise. Even if I find it stupid that it is a shooter game, I can say that the shooting itself feels fun. When you get to grips with the traversal long enough, that does feel fun, and you can integrate some fun systems in there. But I don't think anyone expecting or hoping that over the course of the coming seasons that it becomes something different, I don't think that it has the wiggle room to adjust with the gameplay systems that are in place. It is built to be, you are going around these big structures, either swinging around as Harley or jumping around as King Shark, or, you know, Captain Boomeranging it around. I don't think the facilities are in place to make it more of what maybe people were hoping for.
No, same. I think the structures they've built, the animations they've built, the gameplay rigs they've built are in a very specific framework for those mission types. And I would be, maybe they can do something really cool. I mean, it's funny, my mind went to the Hitman Freelancer mode that came out last year, where IO Interactive basically made like a roguelike version of Hitman, where you're getting different mission goals as you're on mission, and it's like improvise on the fly and go to different spaces, and it all chains together really, really well. And I would never have seen that coming. And that's all using the guts of what is already there from the original, from the three Hitman games. And so maybe there's something, if they're given enough you know, road kind of thing, enough planning, enough creative freedom, and it's not Warner Brothers to death, which is how we got here in the first place, then maybe they can do something cool with the rigging that's there. I think it feels like a miracle if that's the case. But they've committed to multiple, they've got seasons, they've got all these months of content and everything, they've already said Joker's coming, like, they're gonna be maintaining it if there's a player base there. And to be honest, there's obviously a critical consensus. We've done a bunch of videos on it. It's a pretty bad game, like the way you analyze it. But people are liking it, like, which is a weird way to phrase that. Cause, like, oh, you're liking your bad game, but it's like there are a lot of repeat elements to that towards the end.
Again,
of that game.
We always stress in the coverage that there are gonna be people who like this.
Yeah,
like, looter shooters are successful. You know, snappy fun movement that can be translated to a winning formula. There are people who are gonna be enjoying a looter shooter DC game. For me, the issues for the creative level. But, you know, I'm going to be checking out the new seasons as they come. If I can get past the having to fight the same things over and over again aspect. But I'm interested to see how the story resolves. You know, the whole thing with the league, there's clearly, you know, I'm not going to get into a rant.
I'm curious about, yeah, I mean, go check out your coverage, like you and Josh's coverage, the ending video, the review video itself. Like, we've got a lot of Suicide stuff, but there's a full spoiler chat in there as well.
And there's another video that I'm currently working on how to, where does Batman Arkham go after all this, which is an interesting question to pose.
Especially with Arkham Knight back in the sales charts again.
Yeah.
Like, if anything, it's reignited the love of that we had for Rocksteady beforehand, where it's just remembering how stellar they used to be. So maybe, never say never, I guess, in the gaming industry. Jack Jingle says, what are your thoughts on easy modes? Currently playing Final Fantasy VII Remake in anticipation of Rebirth and was getting slapped around on standard difficulty, so I dropped it down to easy and now I'm having a whale of a time. Surely enjoyment has to come first.
Yeah. just enjoy yourself. Well, it's one of those, like,
I'm poisoned. I'm toxic gamer brain. I'm really? Like, I can't do it uneasy. I've got to
well,
do
no,
it
like,
unmedium.
That's you personally, though.
Oh, yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. Like, oh, no, I would never impose it on anybody.
It depends on what you want out of the experience. Mm. I think if you are feeling frustrated by the difficulty, then the game is there for your enjoyment. You should change it and adjust how you want to. If you're there and you find enjoyment in extra challenge, then you can bump it up. For me, it's one of those, no one should be invested in how other people are experienced. I don't know, unless you're skipping cutscenes.
We've got to draw the line somewhere.
In which case, you hurt me deeply. But if it's like, if you're there and you're having a good time and you feel like you're still getting what you want, if you feel like there's a respectable level of challenge, whatever, that doesn't even matter. As long as you are enjoying the game, then that's fine. No one can take that away from you.
No, I'll put it on easy mode if me and my wife are playing through something. Like, we played through Bioshock Infinite for the first time. It was her first time a few weeks ago, and I just put it on easy because I don't have to worry about dying and whatever. And that was great. But for me, overall, I've talked to Josh about this on various podcasts and stuff, but like, I always like the idea of a developer curating a level of difficulty, i.e. the lens of artistry kind of thing. It's like Elden Ring, the Souls games. Mm-hmm. They find ways of mitigating difficulty through gameplay mechanics, through assists you can summon in or whatever it is. But there's still a curated level of challenge you're supposed to be getting.
Yeah.
So when I choose to put it on easy, I feel like I'm missing out on some part of the vision that's there.
I feel like it varies. It has to vary depending on, like, when you have those different difficulty levels, because no one can tell me that when they play Call of Duty on veteran mode, that's how the game is meant to be played.
No, true.
Like, that is where you just got grenade spam constantly. At that point, it just becomes I'm going to take this inch of cover and maybe hopefully kill enough people to then be able to make it to the next spawn wave to kick off or whatever. Mm-hmm. That is, for me, if it's got tiered difficulty modes, then that to me implies that the game is meant to function on all those modes at a certain level and provide you with it. I do agree with you, though. I personally prefer it when the game has a regimented, everyone has a set difficulty and this is what you work with. Obviously, that's going to be prohibitive to certain players, but that's also totally fine. Like, I think, like, difficulty modes are there for games that can withstand them and withstand the pressure of either making it more hard or making it more easy. You know, Halo is the perfect example of this. If you just want to go through the story and enjoy, you know, the fun Master Chief vibes, you can put it on easy, just shoot a bunch of grunts.
True.
But there's equally, if you want to play it on heroic or legendary and do it with all the skulls and do all the challenge and stuff, that has its own fun. So it just really just varies. I don't think every game should have tiered difficulty.
No. Well,
but when it's there, it's totally fine.
Yeah, I think as well, like, I do like a challenge. Like, I do like overcoming a challenge. Like, there is a unique feeling to beating something like a Souls boss, or at the minute, like, I cannot get the hell off Tekken 8 online, and playing a fighting game online is one of the easiest ways to get pasted into the ground. But I'm very much comfortable there, and like, yeah, you lose a bit at the start, but then you get in a groove for it, and then winning a fighting game online is one of the best feelings ever. Mm-hmm. And it's like, especially when in Tekken 8's case, where it comes down to specific frames and you're just clinching the win.
That video you showed me earlier on.
Yeah, I just posted it on Twitter as well, where it came right down to the last little two ankle kicks and mine connected first. But it's like, I do like that. I think I get something out of that in a way that I wouldn't get that if I knocked it onto easy.
And the other thing as well is that my two biggest favorite gaming experiences of the last like 5 years have been Hades and Elden Ring. And those were games that made me unlearn years of comfortable gaming choices that I had been making. And to the point where it was like, well, no, I'm learning that failure is part of the process. Again, not saying that is a reason why people opt for easy difficulties, not at all. But in terms of going for that and preferring the singular creative vision of like, this is how we want it to be, then I certainly, you know, that was helpful for me in being like, you know, it's okay that I died. It's part of the learning process and I'll get better or whatever.
Do you think, just to round this out, do you think that so much damage wouldn't have been done if they weren't called easy, medium, hard, if it was called like story, combat, I don't know, something else?
That's interesting. I feel like it's good that people who just want to experience the game in a certain way have the easy label on it,
but that's because it's called easy that I think that wider group goes like, well, I don't want my life to be easy. I want to make sure I'm earning this thing.
You know, I feel like it's people just need to enjoy what they enjoy. That's what it comes down to. Like, if you want to play games on easy, then you play them on easy. Mm-hmm. If you want to play them on hard, you play them on hard.
I think it's been interesting to look at it. Like BioWare did it in Mass Effect 3, where it's like, just pick the story mode. It was like they did story and then easy, medium, hard. And I'm sure in story mode,
die or something.
Yeah, they did something where they really mitigated the challenge entirely, which is like, would totally work for some players. But yeah, I feel like that, I mean, I did a whole video. I wanted to call it why we're all idiots for thinking video game difficulty matters.
Yes.
And our boss at the time was like, you can't call it that. That just feels like you're calling out the entire populace. And I ended up being called something like the history of difficulty in video games. But that was in the wake of Sekiro. And because the same conversation was coming around then. And so like my thoughts on like, it's the whole reality of difficulty in games, like the origins of it in the arcade, like they wanted to kill you to get more money. Like it is that. Like that's why difficulty's there.
Never gotten past that chemical plant level in Sonic 2.
Could you pay to get past it? Yeah. But it's like, that's why we have difficulty in video games to a point. So you can look at the origins in Space Invaders, whatever. Like it's all that stuff. Question from Lord Kowalakanth, who says, I'm thinking of starting a podcast. Any tips for starting out / getting things off the ground?
Get comfortable editing audio. Have Audacity on hand. Watch a few tutorials. Get on with that. The one thing that I would always say if you're starting a podcast, and this is going to be dumb coming from a guy who has a podcast about movies, which isn't really the most unique thing ever.
Called
Wheel of Dad Movies.
Yeah.
Make sure that there's a little bit of a unique in with there. Like, what is the hook that you're going with? Because you want a podcast. I mean, it could just be like a fun thing if you wanted to. If you just want to have a little fun chat with people, then you could do that. But I always find the most successful podcasts are those that have a really fun kind of unique hook and dimension to them. Give it some nice visual flair, maybe reach out to a few artists. So if you want to have that, totally, that added dimension to it, go through like a little podcast distributor. I go through Acast, which is what Culture
goes
through as well. There's also stuff like Anchor as well. Although I probably can't mention that on Acast.
You do whatever you want.
But there's different, the main thing is just do it and do it so long as it feels fun for you. That's the main thing. For me, it's a personal hobby thing. I get to talk about movies with my mates. And it's a nice, casual, relaxed vibe. And just take your time with it. Have fun. Mm-hmm. And make sure that the audio doesn't sound bad. Probably worth just investing in a microphone.
Yeah, get yourself, because I ended up buying a mic, because like loads of people have Rodes, R-O-D-E, like Rodecaster stuff. And they're really expensive if you're starting out. Like if you have the money, you could go, and get a really high fidelity mic and everything. But I think that you could start out lower than that. Like
I've got a little blue Snowball.
Yeah, Snowball's a good shout. I can't think what you call the one that I ended up buying, but there was a package on Amazon where it was like £45 and it give you everything. And I remember Googling the company. It's called like a Q9 or something. And it just is like a budget version of a Rode, but like it sounds great and like it totally works. I get audiophiles would be like, it doesn't sound good enough, but whatever. It was totally fine for me. And when I'm recording at home, for me, it's a comfort thing. Like you should be comfortable, getting comfortable recording, getting comfortable, almost doing the double thing that we said before, where you're being comfortable, you're just talking, but you're making sure that it has a construct to it and you're hitting certain beats. Like whenever we do news or even the podcast or anything, we have markers to hit. People have different processes. I like having markers to hit because I know I'm better improvising than I am memorizing. And that's a different thing because it's in terms of delivering like a news report or something. Mm-hmm. But still, if I was just going to sit and talk, I would maybe have a few like pillars to hit and I'll navigate the way between them as I go. Mm-hmm. And also, I want to shout out Dan Durkin's podcast because our own editor started one last year called the Pixels and Perspectives podcast. So go subscribe to that. But like his is very relaxed and very nice and you can tell it's him just enjoying talking. And I think that's being personable is a thing.
Yes.
Like ostensibly, I always thought that a podcast should feel like the conversation you would have had in person anyway.
Yeah.
And that's why like some of the best pods and users that we do are just me grabbing you or grabbing Josh and be like, we need to talk about this thing. And that's all it ever needs to be, really.
Yeah, just have a laugh, have fun.
Yeah.
The worst thing it could be is one of those really awful football podcasts where it's not real and they're just there saying stupid stuff. Like just
football podcast slammed.
Yeah, just have a laugh, just do it. And sometimes you might feel less up for recording on a certain week or whatever. That's totally fine as well. Just you define the own expectations that you have of your own thing.
I think as well, one thing that I always took great solace in is like knowing that you have the final say over what goes live. Like you are recording, you can manage that stuff. Audacity is very easy to use and it's free. So you can manage the volume, you can cut bits out you don't like if you really want to, you can stitch different sentences together. You have the final say on the edit, which like for the longest time in What Culture, we used to record stuff and it would go to a different editor. Mm-hmm. And that still happens sometimes. But that whole thing of like, oh my God, all my mistakes are in there and I don't know where that was. Just, maybe have a little notepad with you, note the timestamp down. You'll get a feel for it.
That's a very good recommendation.
Yeah, and you can go back through, you can tighten stuff up. 9 times out of 10, someone listening wouldn't even notice the thing that you got wrong, quote unquote.
It depends on like, for me, my my podcast is just a casual chat thing. Mm-hmm. So, but I do come prepared with notes and certain facts and things I want to touch on. But mostly it's just we're just going to have a chat like we were having, like we just walked out the cinema or we just stopped the movie or something. So it really depends on what you want to do, really.
I think as well, I'm just throwing a million, I love podcasting. I love the history of podcasting. I feel like I've been with podcasts since the start. like it was obviously the big boom when Ricky Gervais, Steve Merchant and Carl Pilkington took off. And all the, you know, their XFM show became their podcast show across the 2000s. Then everybody started doing podcasts. And I feel like having watched the rise of it over the years, like where podcasts are at now, you do want to find someone that you like you like the style of it. Like, I always loved GiantBomb.com, the Bombcast, and like, you know, Jeff Gerstmann and those guys. And it was on, it was the Hotspot podcast before then. Find people who you like the vibe of. Maybe you like this podcast.
My podcasting experience comes from what we chatted around on here. Like, it's basically just a casual laugh, chat, and then some insight. I think that's the best thing to have. I mean, again, it'll vary. Like, if you were doing like a history podcast and you want to make it educational, and you'd have to maybe work from a script or something, it's up to you. But yeah, no, totally. Like, find something that you enjoy listening to yourself, and go from there. Mm-hmm. And trust your instincts.
Yeah, see what you like listening to and think about why you like listening to it, and then what would making your own version of that bring to either your life or potentially someone else's. Final couple questions. How long we got you and how long we've been doing? 35 minutes?
Do you think I am? Clock King?
There's so many things going on in the wrestling world that I know the wrestling people need to be in, but we will do a couple more questions. One from Matthew McGowan, who says, I'm having a home theater installed next week. 100-inch screen, 4K projector, theater seats, the works. I'm hooking my PlayStation 5 up to it. What game should I play first, and what movie should I watch first to use it to its fullest potential and to break it? This is Matthew McGowan, you're living the best life.
My sound bar broke the other day. I don't even have any audio.
My version of a home theater is like discovering I can turn the big light off and then just put my headphones on. That's good enough.
I mean,
for me.
I'm so glad you discovered the
so good.
Yeah, turning the big light
HDR
off.
Looks great.
Yeah,
horror games stuff. Yeah. That's like shadows. Yeah. Phenomenal.
Do you want to go with games first? Then I'll go with the movie.
You have a PlayStation 5. The most bang whiz, look how much graphics we have game on the PS5 is Horizon Forbidden West. So that'll be on PlayStation Plus, I think. If you haven't played Horizon yet, it's just a hyper ridiculously colorful game. It runs beautifully. Even though I prefer Zero Dawn story-wise, Forbidden West is just a gorgeous game. You can't go wrong with either Horizon Forbidden West or God of War Ragnarok. Like, those are the two temples of just look what this system can do. Also, like a more personal recommendation in terms of something I effing loved, to stop swearing, is Ratchet and Clank Rift Apart. That game's gorgeous, plays so well, like just a delightful game. If you can quote unquote get away with, you know, like a cutesy sort of more kiddie kind of game, because I know that puts some people off, it doesn't for me. Rift Apart is a perfect Ratchet and Clank game. It's just, it moves so well. It's like playing a Pixar movie. Like, it's gorgeous.
I would recommend Spidey 2 as well. I imagine the opening Sandman bit would look so good on that screen.
Also, like, to swing in, if you turn the swing assist off, just swing on a 100-inch screen, swinging at full speed in Spidey 2 would be insane.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. In terms of movies, I'd recommend, because I'm on a big Michael Mann kick at the minute, nice. Heat. If you get, like, the 4K... Ultra HD disc of that, because streaming is going to compress everything, so make sure you get the disc. Have that on that big theater with the lights off, and just bask in it, because that movie will move you to another planet. I love that film to pieces. The stuff that's like you associate with like big screen adventure, Lawrence of Arabia, come on, that's like the biggest movie ever made. You need to have that. It's a masterpiece, dude. It's absolutely fantastic. Even you could do like Bridge on the River Kwai as well, all of those David Lean movies. But yeah, certainly do that. Maybe do like a big Jim Cameron movie, Terminator 2. Would look although the 4K for that is a bit goopy. The AI restoration technology.
See, I was thinking of like my mind went to like animation, like things that'll wow you kind of things, but like, that's why I started thinking of like Horizon and God of War. It was like Spider-Verse is absolutely gorgeous.
Yes, to be fair,
and Across the Spider-Verse is even more so. You could throw them on like animated stuff.
Could do some Bayhem, get some Bayhem in there.
Let's recommend one. What's your pick for Michael Bay?
Technically speaking, I know you didn't like it. I do think Ambulance is his technically best well-made movie. If we're talking about one that I will watch forever and ever and never get sick of, it's The Rock.
I'll go Bad Boys too.
Yeah. Yeah, so yeah, go for something big, but I would say go for Heat, because it's gorgeously shot, really atmospheric, perfect cinema movie, and it gives me an excuse to do the Al Pacino impression again of, give me what you got! Give me what you got!
I used to do, and maybe I can't pull it off right now, I used to do the shortest Al Pacino impression ever, which was just, oh, and nothing else.
Just got a Big ass.
Got a great ass. Do you know what else got a great ass? The UBP, the Intellibanter podcast. Massive thank you to everybody for sending in your various questions. I've been Scott Tailford. That's been you and Patterson. All feel free to do your favorite Al Pacino impressions. Thanks again. Have a lovely weekend and we'll catch you soon. Goodbye.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.